Okay, let's begin by cultivating our motivation. And we could be doing many other things right now. In fact, we could have been born in many other different kind of realms right now. But we weren't. We're human beings with a precious human life, the ability to hear and understand the teachings, and the ability to do something that animals are not able to do, which is to conscientiously and deliberately train our mind, purify our mind, develop our good qualities. Let's really take advantage of this opportunity and not squander it by spending time on objects of attachment or objects of anger. And instead, let's really dedicate ourselves to developing equanimity, love, compassion, and joy for all living beings, and to generating the altruistic intention, aiming for full enlightenment for their benefit. So make that kind of determination now. Okay. So I think that awareness of our fortune is something that's quite important. This awareness of our fortune is quite important so that we can really use our time wisely. Otherwise, the appearances of this life are so strong that we get completely caught up in them. And there might be something that happens during the day. In fact, almost every day there is something that happens during the day, isn't there? That we don't like, that we're annoyed at, that we're irritated by, that we wish that obnoxious person would change their ways. You know, it happens every day, multiple times every day, doesn't it? You know? And we can spend a lot of time just, you know, chewing them out in our mind. Yeah. We're sitting there going over, they said this, I said this, I should have said that. Why did they say this? Next time they do this, I'm going to say that. You know, and could spend a lot of time doing that. We could spend a lot of time trying them in the court of our own heart, you know, where they're the defendant and we happen to be the judge, jury, prosecutor, and district attorney. And the police, and we arrest them, prosecute them for this remark they made to us, sentence them to death, and throw them in prison, you know, all within our own heart, and then say, job well done. Yeah? And this happens every day, doesn't it? You know, if it's not one person or another that we get irritated at. And so we could spend our whole life like this. You know, just our life becomes one irritation after another irritation. You know, with certain, you know, little spurts of anger and outrage, you know, when the irritation gets really intense. But at the end of the day, what do we have to show for that? For indulging the mind in that kind of anger? What do we have to show? You know, we're pretty miserable, aren't we? Yeah, we're pretty miserable. So just holding on to that angry thought, just, you know, best way to make us ourselves miserable. And, you know, then we seek relief from the anger by seeking an object of attachment. Have you ever noticed you get irritated and the first thing you want to do is go to the refrigerator and get something to eat? You know? Like, I'm irritated. I want some pleasure. Give me pleasure. Yeah, so we head for the refrigerator, we head for the shopping center, we head for the television,
we head for the bar. You know, maybe the bar is in our own house. But we want, we seek something that's going to deliver us from the pain of the anger, the pain of not getting what we want, or the pain of getting what we don't want. And then we just spend our whole day like this, you know, day after day after day after day. And meanwhile, we have this precious human life with the ability to practice the path and gain realizations. And, you know, the real tragedy is that we're squandering it, yeah? Because it's hard to get. We can't go back in time and relive things and do them differently. So it's important, you know, from this moment to really, you know, assess, you know, what is a wholesome, virtuous idea? What is an unwholesome, non-virtuous idea? And with this clear in our mind, really steer our minds in a positive direction. You know? If we do so, it brings happiness now, creates the karmic cause to have happiness in future lives. If we don't do that, then we're just rerunning the same old, you know. Can't they do this? Why do they do that? You know, we're so miserable. Or I want this, I deserve that, they aren't giving it to me. Nobody appreciates me. What's that thing that we learned as kids that ends with, I think I'll eat some worms?
Nobody wants me, everybody hates me.
Okay, nobody wants me, everybody hates me, think I'll eat some worms. Remember that?
Yeah.
Didn't, what did we do? We played hopscotch to that, or jump rope, or something, you know? Yeah? And then we just go off and sulk. Yeah? I mean, how many hours have we spent sulking in our life? Could you imagine, you know, if there were something that tabulated the amount of time we spend doing different activities. Yeah? And we could open this little book every morning and, yeah, this is how many hours in your life you've spent sulking. This is how many hours you've spent getting angry. This is how many hours you've spent being dissatisfied. And how many hours you've spent sleeping when you shouldn't have been. And how many hours you spent in attachment. Yeah? And then, you know, and then we just kind of tally it. You know, maybe even it's in the form of an Excel spreadsheet. Yeah, each day, you know, kind of somebody fills it in for us, and then we just highlight the whole thing and, you know, automatically get the total. Yeah? But not very happy living that way, and not very fruitful for our own spiritual practice or for what our higher aims in our life are. Yeah? So it's better just to notice that and see that we can change. In other words, don't get mad at ourselves for that, but instead see we can change. And then to really put the mind, you know, on the kindness of living beings, you know, on their suffering, and generate some compassion for them. Yeah. And then seeing the opportunity to become a Buddha, really generate the aspiration to become one for the benefit of all beings. Now, if we do that, then our life becomes meaningful, our mind becomes happy, you know. Everything is completely changed. And it all depends not on other people, but on how we think. That's the whole thing, isn't it? Yeah, we keep thinking that our happiness and suffering is due to other people. And it's not. It's due to what we think. Yeah, so it all hinges, you know, on the, almost overhead the expression, the tip of a thought. I'm not quite sure how thoughts have tips, but, you know, it just all hinges on just, a little way that we're thinking. Now, whether we're happy or miserable, it's not outside, it's how we're looking at it. So this new book that we're going to begin, the Mind Training Like Rays of the Sun, it really goes into depth in this whole topic. It's called Mind Training, okay? Or sometimes it's called
Another way to think of it, as it's translated, is thought transformation. Okay. So the word lo means mind or thought, and then jong can mean to train, to purify, to habituate. So this whole idea of deliberately transforming the mind. And so that's what this text is about, is how to transform the mind through transforming how we think. Yeah. And then, of course, on deeper levels of realization, getting rid of thoughts altogether and just having direct perception of the nature of reality. But in so much of our daily life, just learning how to think correctly. Because some people, they come into the spiritual path and you hear all this stuff about, you know, discursive thoughts and conceptions. And it's like, okay, I just got to stop having so many conceptual thoughts and leave them. Yeah. And I just rid my mind of conceptual thoughts. But it isn't that. It isn't just squashing thoughts. Because there are good thoughts. And there are good motivations, and we need to learn how to generate them. And eventually, at the stage of Buddhahood, we go on beyond conception. But in the meantime, between now and then, there's a lot of good thoughts that we can generate that will really transform our mind. So it's not just a question of not thinking. It's a question of learning how to think in a correct way. Learning how to think in a realistic way. Learning how to think in a beneficial way. Because what makes us unhappy is all of our unrealistic thoughts. All of our non-beneficial thoughts. Okay. And so this text in particular, it has a whole section on how to transform adversity into the path. And I think that's a very, very precious teaching. Because we're always finding adverse circumstances, aren't we? Because nothing ever turns out the way we want it to. Yeah? So it looks like the whole world is adverse. You know, so many adverse circumstances. Yeah. And so how do we transform those into the path? Because if we don't transform them, then we're just going to sit and, you know, sulk or whine or get angry or, you know, all three. But if we know how to transform the way we're thinking, then that situation, which initially seemed so disturbing, can actually become something that we relish because it gives us the opportunity to transform the way we're thinking. So like I said, these kinds of situations come all day, every day, don't they? Okay. So the mind training, like rays of the sun, there's a whole genre of teachings called thought training. And they include a wide variety of texts. But one of the principal texts is called the 7-point thought transformation. And there's several different versions of this text put together by Geshe Chekawa, Gyaltse Tongle Zampo. There's many different versions of the text. And although the whole history isn't totally clear, it seems like that a lot of these little, because they're little phrases, short sentences. That's what the 7-point thought training is. It's only like a few pages long, not a big deal. And it's just very short phrases on how to practice. And it seems like that those were maybe oral instructions that Lama Atisha gave to his disciples that were then collected afterwards and concentrated and made into a text. And there seems to be different redactions of this text. So maybe different disciples wrote down these things, they're pretty much the same. The points are pretty much the same, but sometimes they're in a different order, sometimes a few different points. So it could be that different people wrote down different things, or there were different lineages of it. But it seems to have been something that started as an oral tradition. What I find very interesting, I was thinking about it this morning, because Lama Atisha is such an important master in the Tibetan tradition. Buddhism had initially spread into Tibet beginning in the 6th century, and then in the 8th century there was a huge persecution, or 8th or 9th, it depends how you count the calendar years. There's a huge persecution. Buddhism almost died out. And then Lama Atisha, who lived in the 10th and 11th centuries, then he came to Tibet, and from him are the descendants of what's called the New Translation Schools. And, you know, and he was a chief person who was invited to Tibet to teach the Dharma in the time when the Dharma had degenerated there. And he was one of the great Indian masters at the Vikramasila Monastic University. In addition to Nalanda, most of us have heard about Nalanda. It's a very famous monastic university, not too far from Bodh Gaya. But there were others, at Odantapuri, at Vikramasila. And so Atisha was from Vikramasila. And some kings in western Tibet invited him. One of them even had to give up his life to invite Lama Atisha to Tibet. And Lama Atisha was a great scholar. It's like he had studied all these incredible, deep philosophical texts and was a master of all of them. And he, you know, also did tantric practice. But when he came to Tibet, the whole lineage of teachings that we have from him is basically Lamrim, the stages of the path, and Lojung, this mind training teachings. So it seems like when he came to Tibet, he really concentrated on very, very practical teachings, things that people could put into practice, you know, fairly easily without having a lot of outlines and complicated debates and vocabulary and things like this. So while the great Indian texts, so many of them are written in the form of debates, you know, Atisha's teachings and the lineage that came after him, you know, much of it is just explaining the Dharma. Now, I think because so many people were already Buddhist, there was no need to refute so many wrong ideas. But also things that were very, very practical. And so it's said that Lama Atisha, his two favorite topics were refuge and karma. Yeah, he talked about them all the time. You know, how to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, how to trust them as our spiritual guide, what their qualities are. And then actions and the effect of actions. Now, so the whole teachings on ethical conduct. Okay, so these teachings, you know, are descended from Atisha. There's a very nice story, you know, again, tracing the roots of these teachings. Because Geshe Chekhawa, who was one of the Kadam Geshis, the Kadampa was the lineage that stemmed from Lama Atisha. And he was reading the 8 verses of thought training, and he came upon the one verse that talked about taking defeat upon oneself and giving the victory to others. And he was so shocked by that. How is this possible? You know, when you're in a relationship with somebody and you're not getting along, to give them the victory and take the defeat upon yourself. So he went to search out the source of this teaching, and different people referred him to Geshe Sharwara. Let's see if I can say it properly. Geshe. Hmm.
Sarawa. Okay? That dashi. Okay. So Chekawa wanted to, you know, went to find him. And Sarawa was giving a teaching on one of the fundamental vehicle texts, you know, of the hearers and solitary realizer path. So he wasn't mentioning anything about bodhicitta. So Chekawa was really kind of disappointed. And after the teachings, he tracked Sarawa down and, you know, and said, can I, you know, I ask you a question? And he asked them about, you know, this verse that he had read in the Eight Verses of Thought Training, Langri Tampa's Eight Verses of Thought Training, and said, what's the source for this? You know, because everybody wants to know that the source came from India. And so then Sarawa quoted two lines from Precious Garland. Those two lines are, may their evil bear fruit for me, may all my virtue bear fruit for others. Okay, there's different translations of this line, but it's the basic essence of it is the taking and giving practice. In other words, may I take upon myself all the wrongdoings and unhappiness of other beings. May they ripen upon me. And may I give them my possessions, my body, my virtue, and may all that goodness ripen for them in terms of good circumstances. Okay? And so when he heard that that teaching was from Precious Garland of Nagarjuna, then he was satisfied that it had an accurate lineage. And he went off and studied Precious Garland for many, many years and meditated on it until he gained some realizations of it. So it seems like before Geshe Chekawa, this teaching on thought training, it was considered a secret teaching. Yeah, we usually think of Tantra as the secret teaching, even though it's out all over the place nowadays. But, you know, these thought training teachings were considered secret. Yeah? We might wonder, why? Why are they secret? Well, if you think about it, the whole notion of taking adversity into the path, the whole notion of may I experience the sufferings of others, may I give my happiness to them, those are pretty far out ideas. You know, may I give the victory to others and take defeat upon myself? Those kind of ideas are not, they're things, first of all, that ordinary people could easily misunderstand. And that people who don't have very high aptitudes or very sharp faculties, they just would not understand it at all and go, what kind of craziness is this? You know, why in the world should I take on other suffering? I have enough of it my own, myself, thank you very much. And why should I take on, you know, take defeat and give the victory to others when it's so clear that they're wrong and I'm right? You know, what kind of nonsense is this? Okay, so you see that it's easy for people to misunderstand these kinds of things. But Geshe Chekawa, you know, he accumulated these different statements from Atisha and then began to teach it as a text and explain it. And due to his great kindness, then we have these many different versions of the seven-point thought transformation that we see now. Okay. And then later masters started writing commentaries on the seven-point thought transformation. And so this text here, Mind Training Like Rays of the Sun, is a commentary that was written in the 15th century by Namkapel, who was one of the disciples of James Tsongkhapa. And it's a commentary on the seven-point thought training that combines the Lamrim teachings with the thought training teachings. Okay, so it's considered quite special in that regard. And so, you know, it's made into a book here. It's not a short text like The Essence of Refined Gold was.
But I thought, you know, I received this text from the lineage, the oral transmission of this text from His Holiness, who received it from Kabji Rinpoche. And so I was thinking that I could give the oral transmission of the text, you know, reading it to you and then stopping periodically to make some comments on things. The thing is, I was reading the introduction, the first chapter, and there's a lot of these Tibetan names in it that I don't know about you, but, you know. But, you know, maybe if we could get through that chapter, the rest would lighten up a little bit. You know, are you in for the oral transmission? Okay. So, yeah, because it's nice to kind of read a book from beginning to end. Sometimes when His Holiness gives oral transmissions, some of these parts he reads really fast. And by reading really fast, it's like, you know, it's like, I don't know how, I can't even read English that fast. So I'll do it a little more slowly. Okay. Okay. So, here. And the actual text of the 7-point thought transformation is embedded in this larger text, which is a commentary on it. Okay. And actually, before I start the oral transmission, let's just go over the 7 points so that we kind of know what they are. Okay. So there's some introduction that explains the qualities of the teachings. And so on, okay? But then the first point is explaining the preliminaries, okay? The first thing is to practice the preliminaries. And then the second one is the actual practice, okay? And so there is where we talk about conventional bodhicitta, which is the aspiration to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, and ultimate bodhicitta, which is the wisdom realizing the true nature, the ultimate nature of phenomena. Then the third point is transforming adverse circumstances into the path to enlightenment. Okay, we all want to go to that one, ASAP, don't we? Okay, but actually doing the first one, the main practice where we're developing the two bodhicittas, that will show us how to transform adversity into the path. The fourth point is the integrated practice of a single lifetime. So how to put the thought training teachings in practice in your life. The fifth is the measure of having trained the mind. The sixth is the commitments of mind training. And the seventh is the precepts of mind training. Okay. And so all these teachings really center upon the two bodhicittas, and of the two bodhicittas, they really emphasize the conventional bodhicitta. Yeah, the aspiration for full enlightenment for the benefit of beings. And they particularly emphasize that because there's two ways to develop that conventional bodhicitta. Remember? Uh-oh. What are the two ways? Okay, so the 7-point instruction of cause and effect, and
equalizing
and exchanging self for others. Okay, so this text is primarily the second method, equalizing and exchanging self for others. Okay, and that method has roots in Nagarjuna and also in Shantideva. And Shantideva's chapter 8 is a brilliant exposition of that. Of that teaching. Actually, I was just working on something by His Holiness and going over some notes I received and some teachings he gave, and it really struck me. At one point he said, my fellow Buddhists, brothers and sisters, please, if you really want to practice, study Shantideva's text, Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life. And that really touched me, the way he said, you know, my brothers and sisters. It's like he was addressing us very personally. Okay, so this equalizing and exchanging self for others, what it hits at, yeah, what it really directly strikes at is our self-centered mind. Okay, that mind that says, me first, I am the most important one. Now, some of our self-centered mind is very, very gross, and it falls into the realm of attachment. There's other kinds of self-centered mind that is more subtle, and this is the self-centered mind that says, my liberation. Yeah, my liberation is more important than others. My spiritual practice is more important than other people's spiritual practice. Okay? So we can easily fall into this, can't we? Yeah. My spiritual practice, most important. My liberation is the most important. Okay? But that's a more subtle form of the self-centered attitude. The very gross forms, the forms that we see all day, you know, our common slogan of I want what I want when I want it. Okay, that's the gross self-centeredness. And that's kind of the level most of us are at right now, aren't we? Yeah, I want what I want when I want it. And I don't want what I don't want when I don't want it. Okay. Yeah. And so it's this self-centered thought that causes us so much pain because we interpret everything in the universe on the basis of me. You know, just even in this planet, there's what, over 5 billion human beings? I don't know how many gazillion sentient beings if you include all the animals and insects. And then what about, that's just on our planet. Then what about in this whole universe? How many limitless sentient beings are there? And we say, who's the most important of all? Well, it just happens to be me. Imagine that. Of all these sentient beings, I am the most important. How did I ever get to be so lucky? Yeah. Now, the trouble is that all of you think that you're the most important. Yeah. And you see, that just shows how stupid you are. Because the first rule of the universe is that I am the most important and everybody should realize it. And that's why I have so many problems, is because I'm surrounded by all these stupid people that don't realize that I'm the center of the universe and that they should do everything to please me and cater to what I want. Yeah, oh, these sentient beings. You know, and I'm working for their enlightenment, and look how they treat me. So, this self-centered mind, you know, which in which we self-reference everything, every small thing that happens is reference to the self. Okay? So, you know, any small thing that irritates you, you know. Today I was irritated because somebody else used my bath towel and it's the second time it happened and I gave the red towel. I was really nice, you know. I was using the red towel and somebody else started using it. I didn't know how. I said, give the victory to others. They can use the red towel. So then I pulled out a green towel. And now somebody else has been using my green towel. Oh, now I've had it, you know. And then, the self-centered mind says, they did that deliberately. Yeah, somebody's really so insensitive, trying to get me. Yeah. And then I'm carrying a thing of yogurt out to my cabin. And Frederick looked and said, look like you're hiding something. And I was. I was hiding this little thing of yogurt. He was deliberately, I told him, but he was deliberately trying to catch me in the act of being selfish. He doesn't know that when I'm selfish, nobody's supposed to notice it. You know, deliberately exposing my selfishness. Oh, my goodness. You know? And so you go through the whole day. Yeah. And every small thing is self-referenced, isn't it? You know, this person did this deliberately to make me unhappy. Yeah. It's not just that they were mindless, you know.
You know, it's not just that they were hurrying. It's not just that they were busy and had a lot of things on their mind or that they were suffering. But they're out to get me. You know? And then every small thing, you know, referenced in terms of me. Yeah. So then we become so easily offended. Yeah, any small thing people say, we're offended. They don't trust us. They don't respect us. They don't appreciate us. Yeah. Any, you know, so we become really quite prickly. And the whole source of it is the self-centered attitude. Now, that's the source of the whole thing. Yeah? Just the self-centered attitude. So it would be very nice. We should actually be the ones that keep that tally of how many times we get aggravated or irritated or annoyed each day. And each time, you know, we make a little mark. Say, my self-centered thought fooled me again. Yeah, 5 minutes later, my self-centered thought fooled me again. 5 minutes after that, you know, self-centered thought fooled me again. Yeah. And then maybe if we did that, it might sink into our mind that it's not other people that are the cause of our suffering. You know, it's our self-centered mind. And then when we realize that, then we can start giving all the pain and worry and aggravation to the self-centered mind. Yeah. And then taking on the suffering of others and giving that to the self-centered mind. And then with an attitude of kindness and compassion and cherishing others, giving them our body and possessions and 3 times virtue. And so if we're able to practice that, we become so much more relaxed and happy rather than, you know. So Kathleen, I think you made beans today just because you know that I can't digest them. And you did it a few days ago, too. Kevin, oh, he should know better. He's even lived here longer. They have a conspiracy. Yeah. They're being passive-aggressive against me. And I've been thinking about it all afternoon. Yeah. So this is exactly what I was talking about, how we waste our whole life. Yeah? Okay. Okay, so let's read. If we have beans tomorrow. I hope they'll make me tofu. Okay. But you see, you know what the mind goes to? Oh, completely ridiculous. Okay. So here is Namkha Pel's introduction. It's his homage and his request. So he says, at all times I take refuge in and prostrate at the feet of the sublime and infinitely compassionate spiritual masters. Out of their immense love, may they care for me in every moment of my life. Isn't that beautiful? Now, how do our spiritual masters care for us in every moment of our life? You know? Do they come and bring us tea? They come and bring us chocolate cake. They praise us and tell us that we're the best disciple they've ever had. You know, that's what we think how they should take care of us, isn't it? When we do the smallest thing, our spiritual mentor should come and say, oh, you sacrifice so much. You know, you're wonderful. I mean, that's what we think. But how is it that our spiritual masters take care of us? They teach us. They teach us. That's the chief way that they benefit us, is they teach us the Dharma. You know? And by teaching us the Dharma, they guide us on the path. So it doesn't matter whether they're teaching to a crowd of several thousand people
or to us individually, but, you know, we have to hear the teachings as personal instructions. You know, it's so funny when we hear the teachings to the whole crowd, you know. Like if I teach this, then somebody could say, oh, she was talking to so-and-so when she said that. It didn't really apply to me. Yeah. And so we get out of it that way. You know, or if something's a hard teaching, it's like, well, you know, I want my own personal teachings according to my own level. You know, we expect the teacher to stop everything they're doing and give us our personal teachings for us, you know, because we're the most important one. Yeah. But then, of course, when we get some kind of personal advice, we feel that our teacher's attacking us. Yeah. Oh, they said to be careful about the 8 worldly dharmas. Are they seeing how much attachment and aversion I have? Is that obvious? You know? How dare they point that out to me? I remember one time, Kenzer Jeffa Tekcho, he wrote me a letter, and I don't know why, and we were corresponding about something, but in it he just said, you know, be very, very careful when your teachings about the worldly concerns. And my mind went, you know, I'm doing something wrong. You know, I must be doing something awful, and he saw this, and he's pointing it out, and I'm a failure, and, you know, went into this whole self-centered trip. Because that's all that self-denigration is more self-centeredness, isn't it? You know? And then I finally calmed down, and then I realized, you know, I don't know why he said that, but in any case, it's good advice, and I need to hear it. Yeah. So whether, you know, I mean, stop projecting all this stuff on how terrible I am, and he must be saying this to me because of that, and just realize, hey, this is very good advice, and I need to pay attention. Yeah. Regardless of the state of my mind. Because you know what? Until I reach the path of seeing, and I'm a long way from the path of seeing, the worldly concerns are going to be something I have to be careful of. So, you know, okay? So, you know, whether we have individual teachings or whether teachings to the whole group, it's something that we need to listen to. You know, some teachings, of course, may be too advanced for us. The teacher's teaching some very, very advanced text. Then we still take it as personal advice, but we see that we don't necessarily have to force ourselves to practice every aspect of it right now, because we need to create the best, what we see that the best way of practicing it is to create a good foundation, and so to go back to the ABCs. Okay, and so then Namkapel gives a prayer of devotion, and he says, arising from the source of love and compassion, the ship of the awakening mind is well launched. Awakening mind is bodhicitta. That's how it's translated here. So above this ship, above it billow the great sails of the 6 far-reaching attitudes and the 4 ways of amassing disciples, which are driven by the wind of enthusiastic effort that never slackens. Perfectly, it carries embodied beings across the ocean of cyclic existence, landing them on the wish-fulfilling jewel island of omniscience. Okay. I prostrate, placing my head at the feet of the leaders of the spiritual lineage, the subduer who is our supreme navigator, the powerful one, Shakyamuni Buddha, Maitreya and his spiritual followers, Asanga, Vasubandhu, and Vidyakokila, Manjushri and his followers, Nagarjuna, and the supreme wise saint, Shantideva, the ruler of the golden isles of Samantra, and his first disciple, the noble Atisha, and Tatisha's Tibetan disciple, Drumdompa, and the 3 spiritual brothers, Potawa, Puchungpa, and Chengnawa. Tsongkhapa, the second conqueror of these degenerate times, okay,
So prostrating to the whole, you know, all the major teachers in the lineage. So starting from the Buddha and then going to, there's two major lineages, one of the profound teachings, one of the vast teachings. So the vast teachings emphasize bodhicitta more, and that's the lineage through Maitreya and the Sangha Vasubandhu and Vidyakokala. And so, you know, on the painting in the meditation hall, yeah? So as we face the painting, those teachings are on the Buddha's right. So they're on the left as we face the painting. That's that lineage, the vast or expansive lineage of bodhicitta. And then on the other side, on the Buddha's left, or on the right as we look at the painting, is the lineage from Manjushri, Nagarjuna, and the Supreme Wise Saint Shantideva. Actually, Shantideva is sitting in back. But anyway, Manjushri, Nagarjuna, Aryadeva, Buddha Palita, Chandrakirti, all the masters of the wisdom lineage, the profound teachings, profound meaning, the ultimate nature of reality. Okay? So from both of those teachings, then prostrating to the ruler of the Golden Isle of Sumatra. So it's not a political ruler. It's referring to Serlingpa, who was one of Lama Tisha's three main teachers on bodhicitta. And, Serlingpa lived in Indonesia. So there's this incredible story about how Atisha went on a boat ride from India to Indonesia. It took 13 months, and there were water monsters and hurricanes and everything, you know, and almost died many, many times just to get there. Okay. And then he spent 12 years checking out Lama Serlingpa before deciding to receive teachings from him. Yeah, so why it says in the Lamrim that you might want to take up to 12 years to check the qualities of a teacher. Of course, I guess Atisha was young and Serlingpa was young and had that time to spare. Okay. Then Atisha came back from Sumatra and, was in India. And then after that, that's when the Tibetans invited him to go to Tibet. And then his primary disciple was a layman, Ajahn Dompa, yeah, who was seen as a manifestation of Chenrezig. And then Ajahn Dompa had many, many, many disciples, but the three that carried on these the Kadampa teachings are called the three spiritual brothers, Potuwa, Puchumpa, and Chengnawa. And then Jason Kapa took these three lineages of the Kadam teachings and brought them together again. Okay, and so Rinpoche's teachings sometimes are called the New Kadampa teachings. This is not to be confused with the NKT. Okay, a totally different ballgame. Okay, so making prostrations and paying homage to all the leaders of the tradition who practiced and actualized these teachings. Okay, so who propound the individual spiritual paths of these great pioneers with extreme lucidity and coherence. Supreme among all his wonderful teachings are the means for activating the awakening mind. I shall expound his perfect teaching with absolute accuracy. Those fortunate to follow the way of the great vehicle should pay close attention for true appreciation. This exceptional oral transmission of the great vehicle mind training and instruction for cultivating the precious awakening mind of bodhicitta will be explained in two main parts: an introduction giving the historical account of the lineage of these teachings, including their unique qualities, which will encourage the intelligent to appreciate them with genuine interest. In other words, the advertisement for the teachings. Okay, telling you all the good qualities and how they'll help you so you get all revved up and you really want to get them, okay? And then the second is the explanation of the actual teaching, a most royal instruction.
Okay, so now we're going into the introduction. The background to these teachings can be presented in two ways. First, by relating the common greatness of the teaching and the historical account of the lineage. The authenticity of the teaching is clarified. Okay, so making sure that the teachings are authentic, that they can be traced back through a valid lineage to the time of the Buddha is something very, very important. You know, and that's why there's so many prayers of lineage lamas and why, you know, the lineage is emphasized so much. Because if you can trace the teaching back to the Buddha, then you know that it originated in the mind of an enlightened one. It's not a teaching that somebody made up last month and then advertised in the New Age Times for $99.99, you know, but special price for you, it's on sale. You know, it's not a teaching that somebody made up last week. Okay? And so this is something that's very important, especially nowadays, you know, when we have such a spiritual supermarket. Yeah? I mean, you go anywhere and everything is just advertised. And, you know, you're really using the Western marketing skills to grab people in and make them feel that if they don't get this teaching, they are missing something big time, you know. And, you know, that's not why we should approach the teachings, because, you know, we like this kind of glitzy advertising that we see nowadays. But the advertising that Nankatpel is giving is the advertising of, it's a teaching that comes from the Buddha through a valid lineage. That's why you should listen. Not because this guy can, you know, walk on coals and can juggle eggs and read minds and, you know, do whatever, okay. Yeah, but because the teaching comes from the Buddha. Okay, secondly, through explaining the particular eminence of the instruction with regard to its extraordinary function, a respect and appreciation of the spiritual value of this instruction will be created. Okay, so when you hear about the good qualities of the instructions in this text and how they function to lead us to enlightenment, then we'll also see their value. Okay, so now we go into the historical account. So this begins the first two lines of the seven-point thought transformation, which I said with the introduction. Here they come. And it says, the essence of this nectar of secret instruction is transmitted from the master from Sumatra, Serlingpa. Okay, so those are the lines in the seven-point thought transformation. And what follows is Nankatpel's commentary on it. Okay? So in general, the 84,000 collections of Buddhist teachings, or the three progressive turnings of the wheel of the doctrine taught by the Buddha, can all be condensed into two intentions: to put an end to all types of mental distortion with regard to the I and the misconception of self, and thereby to acquaint ourselves with an altruistic attitude through which we take responsibility for the welfare of others. Okay, so all the teachings are aimed towards realizing emptiness and generating an altruistic intention. Okay, towards wisdom and bodhicitta. So the former theme, which was destroying the misconceptions of self, the former theme was expounded in the spiritual paths of the two vehicles of the hearers and solitary realizers. So teachings on selflessness we can find in the fundamental vehicle teachings in the Pali Canon. Okay. This was expressed in the corpus of the fundamental vehicle teachings for the benefit of those belonging to those categories, so for people with that kind of aptitude. The theme of the latter, so the teachings on bodhicitta, involved the causal relationship between the great vehicle teachings in the general discourses and the secret teachings of Tantra. So it talks about the relationship between the Mahayana teachings that are found in the general Sutrayana approach and the Mahayana teachings in the Vajrayana approach.
Okay? So generating very, very strong bodhicitta, that will make you fit to be not only a Mahayana disciple, but also a Vajrayana disciple. Here, for those who are fortunate, are explained the teachings on the practice for cultivating the awakening mind. It is the entrance into the practices of the great vehicle and the means for attaining the fully awakened state of complete omniscience. Yeah? Good advertising? You want the state of fully awakened omniscience? Moreover, all the teachings of Buddha, the transcendent subduer, pertaining to activating the awakening mind are found in the three systems introduced by the great pioneers. All these are sacred and ultimately supreme spiritual nectar capable of revealing the non-abiding state transcending sorrow, the nirvana which destroys the 84,000 kinds of disturbing emotions and their creations, even all such misery as birth, aging, sickness, and death. Okay, so these teachings are leading us to non-abiding nirvana. Okay, non-abiding nirvana is different than ordinary nirvana. Okay, ordinary nirvana is attained by the hearers and the solitary realizers. And it's the liberation from samsara. Bodhisattvas also attain that. It's liberation from samsara. But the non-abiding nirvana is very special because it doesn't abide in the two extremes of samsara and pacification. Okay? So the two extremes, samsara and pacification, living in cyclic existence is one extreme because there our minds are completely overwhelmed by afflictions and the karma that causes rebirth. Pacification refers to the nirvana of the hearers and solitary realizers. Okay? It's a peaceful state where you've attained liberation for yourself, but you've forgotten about other living beings. Okay? So the non-abiding nirvana doesn't abide in either of these streams. The extremes, either the extreme of still being caught in with all our mental afflictions and cycling in samsara, or the extreme of having removed the afflictions but still having this subtle self-centered thought and thus not having full omniscience. So non-abiding nirvana goes beyond those two, and it's actually the state of full Buddhahood. Okay? So remember that. Yeah, because that term comes a lot in a lot of different teachings. In general, the term nectar in the text refers to the elixir which provides immortality. So it is here, just as a proficient doctor, when diagnosing an illness, prescribes a medicine that can relieve the patient of his sickness and even prevent his death, so the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras tell of the finest type of medicine, even the smell of which is said to drive away the most venomous of snakes. Okay? So a doctor, you know, looks at the patient, diagnoses and prescribes medicine. So the Buddha, as the doctor, diagnoses our illness of cyclic existence. And here, the special medicine is the Perfection of Wisdom teachings. Okay? Even the smell of which is said to drive away the most venomous of snakes. So if you practice even a little bit of the Perfection of Wisdom teachings, it challenges all the self-grasping. These teachings constitute the universal panacea that can provide true immortality. Now, do they really mean immortality in the ordinary sense of immortality? That if you listen to these teachings, you're never going to die? Do you want to live in this body that gets old and sick forever? Yeah? Okay, here immortality doesn't mean that you never die. What it actually means is that you're no longer born in cyclic existence, and so therefore you never face death in cyclic existence. Okay, because why do we die? What's the source of death? Birth. If we weren't born, we wouldn't have to face death. Okay. What's the source of birth and cyclic existence? Ignorance, mental afflictions, and karma. Okay? So if we banish the ignorance, mental afflictions, and karma, then we do away with birth and cyclic existence, and then we attain the deathless state, which is nirvana. Okay, so immortality refers to nirvana, the deathless state. It doesn't mean living forever in this body. Okay? So by developing the intention to realize the attainments of the hearers and the solitary realizers, we can familiarize ourselves with all aspects of that spiritual path, which can result in the attainment of the state free from birth, aging, sickness, and death. Yet developing the intention to realize the supreme, the unsurpassable, fully awakened state of being, the ultimate goal of existence, together with total acquaintance with the entire scope of its spiritual path, can result in the omniscient state of full enlightenment, the state of the one who has gone beyond to thusness, the state of a Tathagata. Okay, so he's saying you could attain arhatship, but if you really want, you know, the higher attainment, if you really want the supreme bliss, go for Buddhahood. Okay? It's harder, takes longer, but it's more worthwhile for everybody in the long run. Okay, this is the point of complete cessation, the state of a Tathagata. This is the point of complete cessation of every disturbing emotion, which even the worthy saints, the arhats, among the hearers and solitary realizers, and even the great bodhisattvas, the bodhisattvas on the pure stages, have not completely eliminated. Now here, I wish I had the Tibetan text. My Tibetan's not great, but it seems to me there's some mistranslation here, because it's saying that this teaching will bring you to the complete cessation of every disturbing attitude, which even the arhats and the bodhisattvas on the pure stages don't have. And that's not true, because all the arhats and the bodhisattvas on the pure stages have eliminated all the afflictions. They're never born again in cyclic existence. So I think here, when it says every disturbing emotion, it's not just meaning the afflictions. It must also be meaning the imprints of the afflictions. Okay, so the cognitive obscurations, because the cognitive obscurations, the imprints of the afflictions, the appearance of true existence, yeah, these are things that the arhats and the pure level bodhisattvas have not yet abandoned. Okay, but I don't have the Tibetan text, so I can't check it. Maybe somebody out on the web has it, can check it. Okay, so let's stop there tonight.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May our paths apply completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable, and their divine actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the 3 worlds always increase. Guru Ratna Mandala Kanyatayami.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore in in the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness, powerful to drink out so generously. May you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially Ashravasti and the